Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And hello to my wonderful, wonderful audience who gets more wonderful every day and week. I am just continuing to be very proud of having this relationship with you by radio every week. I just came back from a great conference at the William Glasser Institute in Raleigh, and a number of you came up and mentioned that you listen to me regularly on the radio show. I can't tell you how satisfying that is, how wonderful that is, and how important the show has been to you. And, we're on the cutting edge, folks. We're the pioneers. We're the meaningful few. That's a nice phrase, the meaningful few. Actually, all folks are meaningful, but we are, in our field, those who are doing what's right. I want to talk a little bit just about what's been happening with me some more, because that's all very, kind of very new things going on. But I want to tell you that we have really, really a good guests. People you probably haven't heard a lot, but who are doing enormous work and who are influencing and have influenced a lot of what you hear out there. Let me just check to see if they're there. Kermit, Louisa, are you there?
We are.
Hello.
You are. Hello, you're there. Great, great. Well, I'm going to catch folks up just for a few minutes on what's happening in my arena, and then we'll go to Kermit and Louisa, and I'll introduce you to them. They're one of those rare folks who really do live meaningful, dedicated lives and do it together. Excuse me. They do it together as a couple. In my world, you know, about 3 months ago, I'm not even sure how long now, I started doing my frequent alerts and that are coming out on an average about once a week that catch people up on meaningful things and important things that are going on in my work and in the work of other people. And I also decided that since my blogs, sometimes two or three of them, were getting more people reading them than some of my books over a lifetime, that I really should be, and Ginger and I have talked a lot about this, doing more and more blogging. So I started to do more blogging on MIA, on Mad in America, and on a place that I used to blog, which is one of the top websites numerically in the world, and that's Natural News. And I have a lot of affinity with Natural News, and as I'll be talking to you later, I'm just learning and putting more on diet talked about and indeed not sufficiently thought about until recently. Well, one of the results of this is not only getting a lot of readers on the blogs, usually in the thousands for each blog, our website, according to the latest statistics, in 3 months jumped 860,000 places. Now, just imagine that. Not going to tell you where we are now yet, but because I'm not too proud of it. But I think in a month I'll tell you where we are. You can probably look it up. But we are really moving. We have literally moved 860,000 places. It just knocked me over. And I mean, most places, you know, and there's a natural movement of maybe 50 or 100 over maybe 500 if you're a big blog, or 1,000 if you're a very big blog. So we're moving, and a lot of it, really all of it, is you. It's my audience. So thank you for that. And I have a very big project that I've been working on and coordinating. My first contact was Kermit, who we'll be talking to soon. But a big project on Madden America. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., it's been changed from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., the judge in the Michelle Carter case is going to sentence Michelle for a crime she supposedly committed. He certainly thinks she did at the age of 17. And the crime has to do with texting and encouraging her boyfriend to kill himself, for which the judge has found her guilty of manslaughter. There are many, many issues. I'm not going to talk about them because I promised I wasn't going to get into anything too deep. I promised the attorneys and myself until the final act in this tragedy occurs tomorrow with the sentencing. And I'm just hoping and praying for a very limited sentence for Michelle Carter. Because Michelle Carter, who has been painted as an evil child, the epitome is of mean texting, is in fact one of the most loved people in her community. Community of 8,000 outside of Boston. In fact, I'll give you just this one tidbit. The school, even though she was charged with manslaughter, charged and indicted for manslaughter and going to trial for it, even though that happened, the school brought her back for her senior year. This happened in the summer. And secondly, the class voted her that year, the year the newspapers were vilifying her, voted her the most likely to brighten up your day. And that's considered a really important senior class award. So that's just a tidbit of what really this case is about. And we're going to look at psychiatric drugs. We're going to look at the texting that goes on that isolates our children from the parents. We're going to look at the society in which they live. And I'm going to ask and answer the question and say that among all the folks I know involved with this case, the most innocent was 17-year-old Michelle Carter. Now, here's the excitement. Thursday afternoon, tomorrow afternoon, 2 p.m., after the judge announces his verdict, I will put the last little touches on the first in a series that will be going up on Madden America. We haven't determined the length of the series yet. The first one's written, the second one's outlined, which is going to tell the true story of Michelle Carter, the true story of her boyfriend, their involvement with psychiatry, the nature of their lives and their families. And it's going to be quite a shocking revelation because the media has not covered my testimony. The media has not covered my testimony, and yet I was the only expert in the trial, either side, and was on the stand for a day and a half of a relatively short few-day trial, and was the voice of what had happened to Michelle Carter. So we're still dealing with this media. Well, that was a longer introduction than usual, and now I want to... But anyway, get ready on Madden America for a series on Michelle Carter and her life and the meaning of the story. And I'll also be announcing it, of course, on my frequent alerts tomorrow as well. It's a coordinated effort working really hard with the wonderful folks at Bob Whitaker's website. Kermit Cole is a veteran and a founder, and he's one of our two guests today, of the MIA, of Madden America, powerful and influential website. Cutting edge of psychiatric reform. I'm going to aim at their numbers someday. I hope. Broad, amazing. They have in their format. Kermit was actually of the Madden America Foundation. I dealt with him years ago when I would put things up occasionally. Now I'm very regularly putting up things on MIA. He's in Santa Fe, Mexico, as is his partner, whom we'll meet soon. And he works with couples and individuals and families. And he's very much believes that human beings live, grow, and exist in what he calls dialogues. And I mean just almost exactly the same thing when I talk about the social context in which people live. And he's also a board member of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health. I think that those two groups, MIA and the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health, are the leading institutions in reform work at the present time. Just proud to be affiliated with them. Louisa Putnam, we just talked on the phone. Oh, by the way, Kermit Cole is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and that's the therapy approach. So when people ask me, what should I become? I don't want to do this and that. I say, marriage and family therapist. Because at least you're going to learn that people live in families, which is your basic starting point. And you may learn to work with families, which is the most powerful tool we have for helping people with big and small problems. Then Louisa Putnam. Louisa has a degree in counseling, it looks like, and also marriage and family therapy. She's a psychotherapist. She's got a long practice working with individuals and couples with also in Santa Fe. And what they told me is that they are now doing a lot of work together as a couple. I think that's potentially an incredibly important approach to therapy. In fact, I often talk about my wife in therapy, often about our relationship, because I want people to know how I live, what I believe in, and the values they're going to be dealing with when they come to see me. And Louisa Putnam has also been a big supporter of numerous efforts related to psychiatric reform and the promotion of alternative treatments. And I think more and more we should find another word for alternative treatments. I think it should be the right treatments, the real treatments, the real approach. Looking for words for that. So I'm welcoming to the show. They're on the same line. Kermit Cole and Louisa Putnam, welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. I apologize for taking a little bit longer of an introduction, but it's just been an amazing day around here. So welcome aboard.
Thank you. Well, we're here because of your strong, you know, your career and legacy. So the opportunity to hear more about what you're doing is a good reason to show up in the first place. Mm-hmm.
Hey, that's very generous, Kermit. Thank you. And hi, Louisa.
Hello, Peter. I am a longtime reader of your work and so appreciative of what you've been doing and this fight that we're involved in. I don't know if fight's the right word, but this transformation, this realignment of mental health care to a more benevolent and effective way of helping people be well.
Thank you. Let me ask directly, do you guys think we're making progress in the world out there? We got a lot more people working on these concepts, a lot more. So that's a lot of progress. I mean, there was a time when I felt pretty much alone. But now there's just innumerable folks out there, and I'm sure I wasn't even alone back then. But do you think we're making progress? Do you have encouraging words to begin with?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think it's I find it's better in terms of sustaining the effort to think of it as an ongoing struggle that started a long time before any of us showed up and it's going to continue. And none of us is going to, you know, declare victory. But I think it's an ongoing struggle against the forces that separate people and bureaucratize human life and take it out of the context in which people actually live. The fact that we live in the relationships that are close to us and mean something to us. But there are a lot of forces that try to take us out of that and make us into, fungible units of economic activity. And, the work that we do is about helping people reconnect with what it really means to be human. I don't like to think even of what we do as being treatment. I like to think of it as a collective effort to learn how to be human together. And in that, I'd say we're always making progress.
Well, I think we are making a lot of progress. And, I imagine you'll agree, for 2 million years, climbing out of the trees, we lived as families and small groups who cared about each other, protected each other, and allowed for a deal of individuality. We all made our own clothes and weapons and so on. So there's a lot of individuality, but a sense of we are here to protect and take care of and love each other. And then with the villages start 10,000 BC, things get a lot more complicated. And I think it's been a process of, in some ways, losing the fundamentals of being human that we're trying to regain now. I don't know if that makes sense to you too.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. I'd also say, as far as answering the are we making progress question, I mean, I can say from the perspective of Madden America, we get a lot of, we know that when Bob started out, he was beleaguered, I think is the popular word right now.
He was certainly beleaguered, as we all are when we start out and they go after us. Bob Whitaker was beleaguered.
Yeah, but, now he tells us about, the young medical students coming up to him and, with really open minds and saying, we see that we have to do things differently than came before. And, you've probably heard the phrase, science advances one funeral at a time. I think, if we want to win every battle, we get from it. But people age out of their careers and new people come in and they are being exposed to everything that we put up on Madden America. And we know that. We know from Bob, who's been out there for years, struggling to learn how to be heard, that he's not somebody inclined toward dewy-eyed optimism about any of this. He tells us that the tone of the response that he's getting is changing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we also see in the
No doubt about that. I mean, I used to practically have to have a bodyguard. So it really, in fact, I did at times have a bodyguard back in the 70s. So the times in that span are changing hugely. And I think we're escalating the change. And I believe that the efforts that you two have been making and working with Bob and Madden America playing a really big role in the growing change now. I'd like to hear about your practice. I think it's wonderful when a couple can work together. I think they can bring a lot of extra stuff into the experience of helping people grow and transform their lives. Either one of you want to begin and just describe what you do?
Yeah, before, just one more thing on the other topic before we move on.
Sure.
We're going to be starting at Madden America. We did one installment of a series of webinars on withdrawal withdrawal from psych meds. That one was led by Olga Runciman from Denmark. But we're putting together a roster of people to speak on the subject, and we'd like to invite you to do that if you'd like to do one, and we can talk about that.
I'd be happy to. I've had Olga on my radio show.
Yeah, sorry to put you on the spot. But
I'd be happy to.
We're putting together. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's wonderful. It'll be a monthly series. We're hoping to get going in September. and, you know, just people from around the world who can speak to this. And I think one of the things that's worth saying, you know, also in answer to your early question, is that we feel that a few years ago, it just would have been almost frightening to do something like this, as you know. I mean, we wouldn't know what kind of blowback we could expect. And I think, but we've been really focusing on having an attitude of, you know, the debate is over and we won it. And here's what you need to know. And that's the attitude we're taking toward this. And the response from the first webinar we did was really strong and very positive. We had next to no negative blowback that I can think of. And so I think that's the tone that we're proceeding in, is that we have, you know, we're not in the business of being unsure anymore about the data that we're working with. I mean, it's very clear. We see it in the science. We see it in practice. And so we're just getting about the business of putting the message out there for the people who need to have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I totally agree with you. I mean, since I was an 18-year-old working in the state mental hospitals, it's very, very clear to me that the psychiatric treatments were doing more harm than good, and what people needed was each other. They needed mutual support. They needed, you know, if they were going to get help, they needed loving counseling, caring counseling. And, yeah, things are changing. I mean, I won't be competitive with you, I don't think, in any way. They're going to be very different, but I've got a big course coming out in the fall, too, on why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. That'll be available online. And speaking, you know, about the young psychiatrist, a young psychiatrist will actually be doing the interactive work of the course, and people will be watching, you know, if they take this big course, you know, a couple of dozen videos by me on various subjects relating to why and how to stop taking meds. So there's going to be more and more choices out there and available educational approaches. And yes, this would have been impossible years ago. It's actually going to be a college credit course. Would have been impossible.
Yeah. Well, it's a rising tide, and it's really feels good at this point to be on it. I know when I got into this field around, you know, about, I guess it's coming up on 20 years ago, some of the things that I might have said that I might say now, I'd have my heart in my hand. My heart would be in my throat trying to say it then. I just, you know, won't get into it, yes. But, you know, it's just career-ending statements that we can now just say are true.
Yeah.
One big thing.
Yes. Well, it's kind of like, you know, in the 80s, on Oprah Winfrey, I told people that psychiatric drugs were brain damaging, and I told them that if it's a guy, and Oprah asked me at the very end, well, what if somebody gives you a prescription for a drug when you go to see him? And I said, well, if you don't feel that person cares about you and you don't want a drug, don't fight with them. It's not safe. Put it in your pocket and leave and find somebody who's going to care about you. And they went after my medical license. I mean, it was a terrifying time. And they had a lot of weight lined up to grab that license, the Psychiatric Association, the state of Maryland. But it was a huge victory, and it got Toxic Psychiatry published and really turned around my reform efforts. But it was terrifying way back then, and I'm sure it was for you 20 years ago. And it still is for folks, but it's getting safer and safer, people. It is.
I think one of the important messages is not only or even necessarily to focus on the problems with the meds or getting off of them, but all of which, of course, we all understand. But I think it's to help remind people that the problems that we've been told for some years now are the province of professionals and of pharmaceutical companies. That was just bad information. Mm-hmm. That the kinds of problems that people deal with, even if they're frightening, even if they're, you know, seem to be beyond our comprehension, it is actually us as the people who know the people that we care about and care about them, who can do it. You know, psychologists, the field of psychology, the field of family therapy needs to be reminded and remember that, you know, we used to deal with this stuff very successfully. You know, we weren't displaced because of a lack of success. We were displaced by superior marketing. And, you know, and by,
and
people like to answer that seems certain. And we, the people that we deal with now in our practice, often are people who were told, take this pill and it will solve the problem. And then 10 years later, they come to us and say, we were lied to and it didn't work. And that's the problem, is how do we get to them before that 10 years? Mm-hmm. So that's what led us actually to get, as you were sort of saying in the introduction, is we were inspired. It was Louisa's idea to go get our marriage and family therapy licenses so that we would have a credential that empowers us to work with these problems in families. Because that's where my career had been. I actually got off the track of doing individual therapy. I'd gone to school. I was intending to be a garden variety psychotherapist, psychologist. And I got drawn to the really hard stuff. I just wanted to be more and more with the people in serious crisis. But I didn't want to be limited by a paradigm that only saw individual pathology. So I went to work in group homes, and I loved that work. And I thought, there's no license that empowers me to do this, so I'm not going to do a license. I don't want to be limited in what I can do. And eventually, years later, Louisa said, let's go get a marriage and family therapy license, because we were inspired by Open Dialogue, which has always has teams working with their patients. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now. Mm-hmm. You're,
Louisa, I hear you getting ready to talk.
Oh, no, I wasn't really. I was just going to say that we aspire to work with families that have, you know, that, to find and be found by families that have someone who's in an extreme state before they get into the system. And we've been working at that here in New Mexico, but haven't really totally found our way to do it yet. We originally tried to get to be part of an emergency response team. And so we're still working on that part of how to find the families before they get, taken to the ER. While we're still making contacts here and connecting with the community and how the community responds to crises, which we're slowly developing some network of knowledge of who those people are. We're working with couples mostly, families somewhat, and always together. And in the model of Open Dialogue, as Kermit was saying, we're able to hold whatever's going on better for being together. And in the Open Dialogue way, Tom Anderson's way, we do a lot of reflecting with one another during a session. Perhaps we could talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the readers know that much about Open Dialogue, but one of the parts about it is that what is going on is the impulse is to have everybody's voice be heard, and the voice of feeling, the nonverbal voice, the voice of body expression as well as words. And so the therapists are also part of that, or the team of people that come to support a family. So the goal, or one of the intentions, is to never leave a session with anything that hasn't been shared as therapists, as helpers. So the reflecting part is one of the ways in which we can talk about what's going on inside us, inside our feeling body, our sensing, and share that with the family or couple that we're working with.
Yeah, I can say that the intention to never walk away with anything on the table, but just to say everything means that when we leave, we don't continue talking about the clients because we've already said everything we have to say. We usually just leave and say, "Wow, it's a great job loving people." The young couples that we work with just start to feel like our children. And I don't know if I could just cross a professional line, but that's just how we feel. It's a great.
You just went up in my esteem. You went up sky high in my esteem. Go ahead.
And it's just, as far as being a couple goes, I'd say, you know, this is wonderful. You know, we keep expanding our family all the time. And I'll throw in one thing, just by the way, about I won't say any details about them, of course, but we were working with a couple this morning, and this is just a good example of how the teamwork works. Is that we got to a point that was pretty difficult. I know for myself, I was starting to wonder if this couple really should even be together, and it was a pretty desperate moment. And Louisa was sort of in the lead at that point because we were using an approach called Imago Dialogue that Louisa has a lot of brilliant experience at. And but then it led to a point where we hit a real impasse. And I know I was probably, and what I can say is I felt like I was ready to come in at that point. I wasn't even ready, but Louisa invited me in, actually.
Let's do a reflection.
Yeah, we did a reflection, and my first reflection was, I really don't know where to go from here. this is pretty tough. Maybe we should be considering whether you guys share a sense of what you want your lives to be. But I think because I was coming from a different angle and I had some fresh reserves, we did find something. We got somewhere. We came out, got a fresh perspective. And I think because it was the two of us, we were just able to hold, as Louisa was saying, the situation more gently and without any of the sort of authoritarian sense that is almost inevitable if it's just one person, especially if it's a person who's only one gender, as most people are. Or, well, that's arguable, but but that's another example of why it really works is, you know, we represent, you know, both of the dominant genders. And so it's fair and balanced in that way. And we are also very different people who think and, you know, approach the world and think differently. So we have double the opportunity to find an entry route to any one person that works for them. So that was on good display this morning. I think we kind of, by the end of the session, the couple was in a pretty good state, I think.
Giddy.
The word they used was that
the
wife said that she leaves our sessions feeling giddy, which is significant given that when the first session that she came in, she said, "I'm here to get divorced." So that's progress.
This is so good. My wonderful listeners, I'm really glad you're getting this window in to what happens in good therapy sessions. People leave feeling better, being more hopeful, having direction. This does not happen in psychiatry. People don't go into psychiatrists and leave feeling that way. First of all, their psychiatrists are mostly depressed or caved in by their own unethical behavior. They're out of touch, and they're giving the drugs. This is what therapy is about. It's human beings helping each other get re-inspired to move on positively with their lives. And I think there's a lot of different approaches because we're all such different people. But they all have, I believe, will have in common what you're hearing here, which is people who love their clients, people who really are honest with their clients, people who don't hide behind licenses or whatever. And I deeply believe this. In line with this, Carmen Louisa, I'm developing our next program after the How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Drugs, which has a lot about how to help people in it. It's got a lot in it. And again, it won't be out until the fall, but I want to do a certificate program for anybody to take in how to help folks. And it doesn't matter what your degree is at all. And then you get judged on whether you're wise and decent and ethical, which a lot of the certificate will be about, especially being ethical, which can be encouraged by outright discussions of how to be ethical. I really believe that all people need is some sort of exposure to therapists who love their work and love their clients and will supervise and and teach and maybe provides a few books. There aren't too many. And that anyone with a good heart is a good candidate to then go out there and help folks, and probably in a better position than somebody who's gone through all the training and has got to de-indoctrinate their authoritarianism. That makes sense to you?
100%. Yeah, all of it. Yeah.
I think one.
I think there's a. Go ahead, Louisa. Talking, by the way, again with Kermit Cole and Louisa Putnam. Go ahead.
Kermit and I, in many ways, are also peers. We, our families have gone through, you know, a lot of difficulties, and so the peer movement in around the world now is growing. The Hearing Voices Network and very many different gatherings of peers who are being honored as having the lived experience that a lot of the doctors and psychotherapists and psychologists don't have. And so for Kermit and I, we have our own lived experience. Neither of us were hospitalized, but we had family members who we walked beside, and so that also informs the way we practice, the way we think, the way we interact with whoever, you know, is with whomever is struggling.
And of course, the
yeah,
fact
I
that,
think that's very, very important. Go ahead, Kermit.
I was just going to add that there's the fact that, as we increasingly know, that a lot of professionals really could also be considered peers, but they've been compelled to hide that fact their whole lives. I mean, there's a long and interesting history of that fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I really believe that life is so difficult and the human mind so unruly and hard to manage that we're all peers. I think we are all peers. And I gave a talk many years ago to a very large group of 500 or more people who identified as survivors of psychiatry. And they knew me pretty well, but I don't know that they didn't get nervous when I said in a loud voice, "Well, you know what the difference is between me and all of you?" And I said, "I never got caught."
Yeah.
And of course, there was such laughter and such approval. And that was used against me, by the way, in a book. They said we got insight into Dr. Bregan when he admitted he'd never gotten caught. But, it is a matter of who gets caught or who makes the mistake of asking for the wrong kind of help, because life is difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, it just flat out is.
I'm just a lot of what I do, I act out of a feeling of obligation for the fact that when I hit my really, you know, when my early career, my first career didn't give me the feeling of security and the feeling of being loved that I'd hoped for, that I'd hoped it would. I was trying to be a famous film director, when I realized that the love that you get from being famous to the degree that I achieved it wasn't actually real love. I had to figure that out. And I really hit some hard times after that. I realized this isn't working. And there's a point at which if I hadn't had the opportunity to go to school, I don't know how I would have avoided being in a hospital. And so I'm lucky that way. There's a lot of the most brilliant, fascinating, and worthy and people that I know who have contributed the most to the world, of the people that I know personally, did end up going to hospitals. And, you know, even if they did continue to achieve what they were in the world, if anybody knew what they dealt with in their private life, they'd be horrified and, you know, shun them. So it's a delicate balance that I've seen in a lot of my professional life, too. It's people who were, in fact, holding together, you know, high-level professional jobs and making contributions, who had to somehow balance the fact that what they personally dealt with in order to do that had to be kept secret. That's a difficult life to live.
Yeah. You know, when we evolved as over these millions of years living in small families, everybody knew everybody's secrets. I mean, how far away from the group could you get to do something secretive? You know, and it isn't safe nowadays. I mean, it realistically is not safe to if you want to hold certain kinds of positions in the world, at least it's not safe. I think it's safe for a psychotherapist. I mean, everything I've ever shared with my clients has they've appreciated. And I really can't remember a single incident of a client using something about me that I, you know, told them about. And I'll often tell them about things that parallel what they're struggling with. So they know that I'm not looking down on them, and they know that I have some experience, and they don't feel so alone with them. I think breaking down the barriers is extraordinarily important. By the way, I think it's easier now that I'm older. I mean, that's something I'm sure I'm quite a bit older than you two, but one thing I've noticed now that I look more like great-grandfather than even grandfather, it's a little easier to break down the barriers. It's interesting. There's much less competitiveness toward me, and of course I feel much less than when I was young. Tell us more about stories. I know that's hard, but the one story you told was so useful. Can you think of other stories? And if you're worried about, anonymity, you know, put it in another time or another sex or another age. I mean, it really doesn't matter because most of the things are really universal. But I'd love it if you thought of some more experiences that you've had as a therapist. As therapists together or alone, where your genuineness mattered a lot and where people felt empowered. I should have asked you this before I brought you on the ears. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stories. Some hard stories, but a lot of good ones. Louisa just reminded me of one, actually a friend of ours called us up. Because her son was, to her, and what would be to many people, saying frightening things, doing frightening things. So she was, among them was that he was talking about that aliens were coming, and things related to that. And so we went and talked with her and reminded her that that she has always talked about aliens. And she's up short. And so we said, okay, so what exactly are you afraid of here? Now that he's talking about aliens, why does that frighten you? And after talking a while, I said, so what you sounds like you're basically afraid of here is that he's not going to have an IRA. You know, he's not going to, how's he going to get a retirement account someday in the future? Because nothing that he's saying or doing right now seems immediately frightening. And that relates to, I can draw that to other families. A lot of the families that I have dealt with, that we have dealt with, I think it has to do with recontextualizing their fear and say, so what is it exactly that you are afraid of right now? And then when we can kind of play with the time frame in which these fears are actually playing out and whether something has to be done, actually has to be done immediately, or whether there's any understandings or agreements that we can find that will mean, you know, this person doesn't have to be hospitalized right now, doesn't have to be medicated right now in order for people to feel some sense of safety. I'd call it an illusion of safety, of course, or a delay of the danger that they're afraid of, but not an elimination of it. Then as soon as we can reframe that and basically end up saying, as they would in the open dialogue approach, you know, when should we come back? Meaning, how long do you think you can keep it together till our next meeting? Then that just reframes, I call it the crisis horizon. You know, it's like you know, how far ahead can you see yourselves keeping it together in this context? And in these kinds of conversations, basically what people start out by being afraid of, they realize they don't have to be afraid of. It's not an immediate danger that has to be acted on. And of course, we have a mental health system now that, because of the responsibility that it holds, is compelled to act and deal with what is perceived to be a crisis immediately. And there's very few things you can do that way other than lock somebody up or medicate them. Neither one of them is going to really solve the problem. Neither one of them is going to even reduce the problem long term. But it's what they do. So I think just sitting with a family and saying, what are we really afraid of? And what is it that we don't understand? And what are the expectations that you as a son are operating under that are burdensome to you? I'll lead into one other specific example. The family did find us, first episode, first episode psychosis of one of their children. And somehow or another, they were getting a lot of advice. They were getting, and they weren't unhappy with the people that they were working with in the system, but they somehow had gotten the idea that maybe there was another way. And in the time that we worked with them, I think that's the basic thing we were able to say is, yeah, what you're being told about psychosis is one way that many people look at it. And there's other ways that other people look at it. And these are the outcomes that they have found in Finland by looking at it this way. So there's a bigger palette of options than you were being told prior to today. And in the time that we worked with them, we dug down into some of the family dynamics going back a couple of decades that once we started looking at them were not very difficult to connect to the stress that the child had experienced that led to the events that brought them to us. And, you know, and I think that it really, it gave them just enough of a nudge to go in a different direction. The last time we saw them, the son was getting off of psych meds, was taking control of his own life and he was going back to school. And we haven't seen them since. It wasn't that long ago. But I feel comfortable that we introduced just enough information. As what was it? Anderson would say, the difference that makes a difference.
Bateson.
Bateson says, you know, the difference that makes a difference. I think we gently introduced, you know, a meme that I like to think gave them enough of a new direction that made a difference. I think it was hard for It was hard for them to confront the fact that they hadn't had to confront the fact that some of the parents' experiences from, you know, 20, 30 years ago could have had this result. That was an uncomfortable thing. But I think that we addressed it just enough that they were able to see that this was true and give their son the freedom to make his own choices.
Well, I like everything about how you approach stuff. And interestingly enough, I think my audience is beginning to hear me say that more and more. And I think I had Terry Lynch on from Ireland, and I felt like I was hearing an Irish accent talking, but it was my words. I think that more and more of us are coming to very common ideas, shared ideas about how to do therapy, whether we're communicating with each other or not. And just for my own, a couple of things here that are just so important, you know, are be willing to ask the question, what are you afraid of? Don't be afraid of the answers. Don't be afraid that that people are afraid they'll kill themselves or that they're afraid they'll be violent. That won't make it happen. It's more likely to make it not happen. It won't make them believe in it more now that they've told you that they feel murderous or suicidal. It'll make them see it in the clear light of day in a safe space. You know, just ask folks what's going on and look at what are the worst scenarios and what are you scared of, and you'll learn so much. And just the talking about it usually is such a relief for people, because the scariest thing is to have this in, is to have your worst scenarios, becoming a bag lady, being fired from your job, your wife divorcing you, whatever these scenarios are, your own actions. They're worst when you harbor them to yourself. And when you get them into the light of day of dialogue or communication or sharing, good things happen. And another point I take from what you're saying is folks can often quickly see the relationship between their self-defeating conduct and their lives, what they learned from their mother and their father or their big brother or other people, for better or worse. They can often make those connections, especially if they've reassured it's not a matter of blaming. I mean, for now, look, you blame your parents or not, that's up to you, but that's not what we're doing here. We're trying to figure out what happened to you and what lessons you got from it. And I'm sure that sounds reasonable to you, too. I mean, we're very much on a similar wavelength.
And Louisa was just adding, do you want to say, Louisa, that it's also important to get what happened to the parents, the fact that,
the grandparents. Intergenerational trauma that can, as long as it's unaddressed and unworked with, will keep reappearing and often will, can manifest in a psychosis or a break of some kind. But when we really hold the generations with compassion and as Tom Anderson says, unbind what's been bound in the in-between, which hasn't been able to be spoken, then energy starts to move in a healing way.
One of the ways today, in the session today with the couple, there's a particular dynamic they have that in some ways sort of, it's pretty hard to figure out how to surmount it, but I'm sure we'll figure it out. And I said to them, when we do, every time it happens, you'll laugh. And I feel confident about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You'll have a different perspective on all of this. At the risk of wearing you out, I'd like to hear you talk more about therapy. Go ahead.
I'll just pick up on, since I mentioned laughing, I have a theory about what that's about, what humor is about, which is to me something that goes to something that's pretty fundamental about what I think of as being human. I don't mean to limit it to humans. I think actually we share it with all living things, but we're talking about humans right now, so I'll limit it to that, which is that, which is just the fact that the way we see the world and how we experience the world and what we know of the world is something that's made up of more than just what we see through our own eyes. It's made up of the eyes of everybody that we know and care about, and really all the eyes of everybody that preceded us. The simple term for that is social constructionism, which Louise and I have gotten very involved in studying. But it's just this idea that as humans, how we relate to the world, what we know of the world, how we experience what we experience of the world is woven together of a matrix formed out of social fabric. And that was kind of a double metaphor, but anyway. And to me, what humor is those moments when we realize that there's another way to see something than the way we were seeing it. And jokes set up a moment where you're whipsawed from one perspective to another, and you're reminded that what you know of the world is something that you know through multiple perspectives. And it causes us to laugh because we realize, there's no one way to look at a thing. And it lightens our burden in that moment to realize that we don't have to carry the burden of truth with us everywhere we go. We can experience it through the eyes of everybody that we relate to. And I think that that's, you know, humor. There was one moment when I realized that for me, I thought that's what the title of that book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, I think that has to do with humor. And, you know, seeing that or knowing that the world is much more than just what you can see at any one moment. And so that's why I was saying to this couple, when you see how to get through this impasse and see it through each other's eyes, you will begin to laugh about it.
Mm. Well, I was going to say, Peter, that when I first met Kermit, he was very, very serious. We were...
I'll bet. I think Kermit and I share that, and we do needed to meet somebody who was going to lighten us up a little. Go ahead.
Michael Cornwall and I had come together had met each other at a Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care symposium. And Michael was saying, I'm giving a workshop in alternative approaches to psychosis at Esalen. And so I joined him and invited Jack Rockefeller, who was Kermit's boss at that time at Windhorse. And Jack couldn't come, but recommended that Kermit come. And so we all gathered there. There weren't very many of us that first time, but a wonderful group of people. And then we did two more gatherings like that, where we invited people that were doing significant work in this area of social justice and reform, as you, the language you use, Peter. But I'm saying this all to preface that at that time I saw a very serious, deep thinking Kermit. It wasn't until quite a bit later that I realized that since he was a little one, he was observing the humor in his household and trying to figure out how to make his mother laugh. I think that was the original, or how to make the laughter happen in the house in the way that his brothers were so skillful at doing. And there's a part of Kermit that all the time is listening for the laughter of what can come out of what's being said. It's sort of, yep, I'm going to give this to Kermit. He wants to say something.
Well, I disagree. I don't think I'm always looking for the laughter. I think I'm always looking for the other way to look at anything that is the the object of attention. Uh-huh. And it just so happens that when you do that, very often you end up laughing.
True. It reminds me of a time that I was doing family therapy with a nephew of mine, with a wonderful therapist who was very funny. And I said to her, this family therapy is fine, it's good, but what I really need to learn is it's about humor. And she reached over and put her hand on my forearm and said, it's very easy. All you have to do is tell the truth.
Yeah, but what I'll say about that
is... Oh my gosh, there's the music. Listen, folks, we're actually coming to an end here. Kermit Cole, Louisa Putnam, they both mentioned Michael Cornwall, who has a wonderful volume coming out, look for it, of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology. I've got articles in it, so I want to mention that. And Michael's been one of the more frequent guests on the show. There are lovely tie-ins here between you and a lot of folks we know in common. Kermit Cole, Louisa Putnam, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.